Chapter 22 A Palace Fit for a Chief. I slipped through a narrow entrance in the high stone enclosure and found myself in a tight passageway between an outer and an inner wall. I had no idea what lay inside. A conical tower of carefully laid stone blocks stood in front of me, a solid structure with no doorway and no obvious purpose. As I wandered through the jigsaw of masonry or stonework and hut foundations inside Great Zimbabwe's great enclosure, a feeling of confusion swept over me. I had spent much of the day visiting local African villages of thatched huts made of poles and clay. The contrast now was overwhelming. Why had farmers and herders living in such communities come together to build such a remarkable structure? It seemed a strangely alien and mysterious presence in the wooded landscape. There was no sign of great palaces or temples. Only the imposing great enclosure stands high. Great Zimbabwe occupies over 24 hectares. A large granite hill covered with enormous boulders overlooks a mishmash of stone structures, among them the great enclosure, the most prominent feature of the site. The hill, commonly known as the Acropolis, Greek for high city, is a maze of enclosures formed of boulders and stone walls. The largest of them, the Western Enclosure, was occupied for a long period of time. The Great Enclosure is famous for its high stone walls, built without mortar, and for its solid conical tower, which pokes just above the outer wall. The chief who ruled over Great Zimbabwe lived in this compound, probably isolated from his subjects. Several other smaller enclosures lie to the northwest. But what exactly was Great Zimbabwe? Clearly, it was an important ritual center. The Acropolis was a sacred hill isolated from the rest of the site. To judge from the various imported things like Indian glass beads, Chinese porcelain, and seashells, the chiefs traded their gold, copper, and elephant ivory with people from the East African coast. We know that the men who lived here were chiefs because iron gongs, traditional symbols of African leadership, have been found in the Great Enclosure. Thanks to radiocarbon dating, see Chapter 27, we know that Great Zimbabwe flourished between about AD 950 and 1450. It was abandoned shortly before Portuguese ships arrived off the Indian Ocean coast in 1497. The Portuguese sailed into coastal towns like Malindi and Mombasa in modern-day Kenya, which traded in ivory, gold, and slaves from far inland. In 1505, they built a trading post at Sofala, a long-established Islamic trading station near the mouth of the Zambezi River. They found half-African merchants who would lead small parties upriver and into the highlands of the interior, carrying cheap Indian cloth, strings of colorful glass beads, and seashells. In exchange, the traders obtained gold dust carried in porcupine quills, copper ingots, and, above all, elephant tusks. Some of the traded goods, such as Chinese porcelain and cloth, reached Great Zimbabwe. From their sporadic explorations inland, the Portuguese learned of a settlement built of stone, but never visited it. In 1531, Vicente Pagado, captain of the military force at Sofala, called it Zimbabwe, a place built of stones of marvelous size. There, matters rested until 1867, when a German-American hunter and prospector named Adam Render stumbled upon the ruins. 4 years later, he showed them to Karl Mausch, a German explorer and geographer, who was astounded. Mausch claimed that Great Zimbabwe was the palace of the biblical Queen of Sheba, the remains of a great, gold-rich Mediterranean civilization in southern Africa. He even claimed that a wooden door beam was carved from Lebanese cedar, brought to the site by travelers from the ancient Mediterranean world. By this time, a stream of white settlers were moving north of the Limpopo River, now the boundary between South Africa and modern Zimbabwe. Some came to find gold and get rich. Most were hungry for land and set about establishing farms. Many of the newcomers were poorly educated and looked down on Africans. A large number of them settled on the fertile land of what was called Mashonaland, where Great Zimbabwe stands. It was widely believed that a fabulously wealthy ancient kingdom created by white people from outside Africa lay in the north. My wonderment when I visited Great Zimbabwe was probably nothing compared to that of the first Europeans to set eyes on the ruins after 1871. They stumbled through a maze of crumbling masonry masked by clinging vegetation. The conical tower was barely visible through the trees and undergrowth. Great Zimbabwe came as a profound shock, and it was an archaeological mystery. Who had built these unique stone structures? Were they the work of a long-vanished foreign civilization? How long ago were they abandoned? When some gold beads turned up during casual digging in the great enclosure, excitement mounted. The rumors reached the ears of British businessman Cecil John Rhodes and the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1891. Together, they sponsored a season of excavations at Great Zimbabwe and other stone ruins north of the Limpopo. They chose British antiquarian J. Theodore Bent to undertake the excavations. Bent had no formal archaeological training, but had traveled widely in Arabia, Greece, and Turkey, which seemed an admirable qualification. Fortunately, he took with him E.W.M. Swan, an expert surveyor. Swan produced the first map of Great Zimbabwe. Meanwhile, Bent found gold objects, dug rough trenches, and announced in the Ruined Cities of Mashonaland, published in 1892, that the site was very ancient and the work of either people from the Mediterranean or Arabs. Local colonists loved a book that said a wealthy non-African civilization had built Great Zimbabwe. Academics and white settlers alike maintained that foreigners had built the site. No one believed that the ancestors of the local African farmers could have constructed the great buildings. Such people were thought too primitive and lacking in expertise. When gold and copper objects emerged from Bent's excavations, all the local settler talk was of long-vanished, fabulously rich civilizations from the Mediterranean world, and of great rulers who had colonized Mashonaland for its gold. This is hardly surprising, since many of the early colonists had themselves come to Africa to find gold and make their fortunes. Moreover, if foreigners from the Mediterranean had built Great Zimbabwe, then it could be argued that their successors, the new arrivals who were displacing the local people and carving out farms for themselves, were merely repossessing land that had been seized by the Africans when they had overthrown this once great kingdom. The more ambitious among the settlers were so impressed by Bent's Zimbabwe gold finds that they established the Ancient Ruins Company in 1895 to exploit archaeological sites for their wealth. This was nothing more than an attempt to get rich quickly by digging out Great Zimbabwe and other archaeological sites. It was like Egyptian tomb robbing, but organized as a public company. Fortunately, it soon collapsed because of a lack of valuable finds. Then Richard Hall, a local journalist, stepped in. His archaeological qualifications were non-existent, yet he was appointed curator of Great Zimbabwe. In 1901, he began some destructive excavations. In fact, all he did was to shovel out all the occupation levels from Great Zimbabwe's largest structure, the Great Enclosure. His trenches yielded fragments of gold sheet and beads, copper ingots and iron gongs, among other objects. He also found fragments of imported Chinese porcelain. Hall was not aware of archaeological finds elsewhere and knew little history other than the popular racist kind. First and foremost, he was a journalist and a creative storyteller out to make money from his writings. He wove the miscellaneous finds from his diggings into stirring tales of a long-vanished civilization. A man of great energy and infectious enthusiasm, albeit with the colonial views typical of the day. Hall considered Great Zimbabwe the work of people from the Kingdom of Saba in southern Arabia, in what is now Yemen. This was the land of the biblical Queen of Sheba, who had visited King Solomon. While Hall's excavations caused great excitement among local white settlers, the sober members of the British Association for the Advancement of Science were eager for disciplined excavations. In 1905, they organized an investigation of the ruins by archaeologist David Randall McIver, 1873 to 1945. Randall McIver had extensive digging experience in Egypt, where he had learned the importance of artifacts for the creation of a timeline. Objective and well-practiced, Randall McIver was struck by the absence of any artifacts of foreign origin that were earlier than medieval times. Nothing dated to the time of the ancient Mediterranean civilizations or the Kingdom of Saba. Fragments of Chinese porcelain vessels brought from the East African coast were found in his trenches. From their design, these could be dated accurately, and on the basis of these finds, Randall McIver stated firmly that Great Zimbabwe belonged to the 16th century AD or perhaps a little earlier. Careful analysis of the datable, imported objects showed that Zimbabwe was built long after the Mediterranean civilizations alleged to have constructed it. All the porcelain found with the stone structures was medieval, imported along Indian Ocean trade routes. So local Africans, not foreigners, had built the structure. This was good, logically argued archaeology, but the settlers were furious and refused to believe him. So heated did passions in local white circles become that a quarter of a century would pass before anyone else excavated at Great Zimbabwe. When the British Association for the Advancement of Science arranged for their annual meeting to be held in South Africa in 1929, to mark the occasion, they decided to sponsor new Great Zimbabwe excavations. They turned to English archaeologist Gertrude Catton Thompson, 1888 to 1985. A tough, no-nonsense woman, she had learned archaeology in Egypt with Flinders Petrie. But while Petrie looked for the tombs of nobles, Catton Thompson labored on much earlier Stone Age sites. She had mounted her own Egyptian expedition in 1924 with London geologist Eleanor Gardner. They worked in the Fayum Depression west of the Nile and found small farming sites. Catton Thompson estimated their date at about 4000 BC, the earliest farming settlements known at the time. This up-and-coming archaeologist was an ideal candidate for the excavation of Great Zimbabwe. Her training with Petrie had included both small artifacts and the importance of cross-dating, using objects of known age to date prehistoric settlements. Catton Thompson arrived at Great Zimbabwe by ox cart in 1928. She placed her trenches with meticulous care and dug a deep cutting into the western enclosure on the Acropolis. Using fragments of imported Chinese porcelain and Islamic glass found in her trenches, she showed how Great Zimbabwe had begun as a small farming village before expanding dramatically to become a major center, with masonry and enclosures. Her conclusions confirmed that Randall McIver had been correct. Great Zimbabwe had been at the height of its glory in the centuries before the Portuguese arrived off the East African coast in 1497. This most remarkable of archaeological sites was entirely of African inspiration and construction. Catton Thompson presented her conclusions to the 1929 British Association meeting. Once again, there was uproar from settler interests, but archaeologists everywhere accepted her carefully argued conclusions, which have stood the test of time. Her work ignited such fury among white settlers that no one returned to dig at Great Zimbabwe until the 1950s, when radiocarbon dating confirmed her chronology. Catton Thompson stood firm, despite the abuse. She put away the numerous crank letters she received in a file marked Insane. After the Second World War, her brilliant 1928 excavations laid the foundations for the study of Black African history. Gertrude Catton Thompson never worked in Africa again, but her research led to a powerful conclusion. Racist interpretations of the past do not hold up against carefully argued and well-excavated archaeological data, and her Great Zimbabwe excavations came at an important moment when archaeology was taking hold in places far from Europe and the Mediterranean.